Chris DePentema, the president and CEO of the Connecticut Business and Industry Association. Chris, so happy to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. So the reason we called and wanted you to come on the show was because there was a report earlier this month, I guess it goes back a couple of weeks now, saying that Connecticut was essentially falling behind when it comes to a number of economic metrics. This was a report by Connecticut Voices for Children. The name of the report was The State of Working in Connecticut, and really wanted to get your take on it. So this report said that job growth was lower than the national average. Is that, are those the numbers you're seeing, Chris?
Yeah, no, the Connecticut Voices for Children report did a great job on digging up some data relative to job growth, GDP growth, and population growth. And it's completely aligned with the data that we've been looking at. You know, we look at it every month, really, when the new job numbers come out and population numbers come out every quarter and GDP numbers come out every quarter. GDP is gross domestic product, or some people call it gross state product, which is the output that each state produces. And the Connecticut Voices report is spot on that the, you know, while we've had job growth post-pandemic and post-Great Recession, it's lagged the national average. It took us almost 14 months, to longer than the rest of the country, to fully recover all the jobs that we lost as a result of the COVID pandemic. And obviously that has tremendous economic impact. So the Connecticut Voices for Children does a really good job kind of analyzing that data.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, so let's unpack that a little bit, Chris. A lot to parse here. With jobs perhaps not coming back from the in Connecticut from the pandemic, why not? Businesses reopen, you know, we're working again, we're going out, some of us are even going back into the office. Why has it been slow, and in particular, in which industries?
Yeah, Bridget, really, it's interesting. It's not that the jobs aren't there. They're not being filled. Since about a year after the pandemic, when the federal unemployment extra subsidy went away, which I believe was September of 2021, Connecticut has averaged between 70 and 100,000, 120,000 job openings every month for now going on, what, three plus years since that full recovery. And so the jobs have been there. We just haven't been able to fill them. And while we add jobs each month, it's at a very low rate, hundreds, maybe 1,000 jobs. And it's not even offsetting those who are retiring from the workforce. You know, Connecticut has an older demographic, an older workforce, as does the Northeast in general. I think we have the third oldest workforce in the country. Average age is, I believe, 57 years old in Connecticut. So we have a number of folks who are retiring out. In fact, our labor force, which is those who are working plus those looking for work, has declined by about 30,000 people since pre-pandemic, since right before the pandemic started. So at the same time, we have 77,000 job openings. In fact, a staggering data point that both the Voices report looks at and that we talk about on a monthly basis is that if we had 0% unemployment in Connecticut, if all roughly 50,000 people who are on unemployment got a job today, we'd still have almost 30,000 job openings in the state. So it's not a lack of jobs that are there. It's the lack of people filling those jobs. And so that's really the biggest challenge. And that goes back to keeping people in the Connecticut, attracting people to the state, you know, and the big things there is, and you often hear about cost of living. We've had anemic population growth post-pandemic. We've had about, you know, just over 10,000 people move to the state since the pandemic happened. And before that, from 08 to 18, we actually lost population. We had about minus 1% population loss in that 10-year period. And so we just don't have enough people staying in Connecticut, either after graduating high school or graduating college, and or moving to Connecticut from other states who are workforce age-based, if you will.
Yeah. Chris, could you give us an example of, you know, maybe a company or a business or an industry that has these job openings? 77,000. Wow. You know, that's not a bad number of job openings. If somebody is looking and they hear that, So can you give us, for instance?
Yeah. So when you unpack the current 77,000 job opening, a couple things. First of all, people often, you know, respond when I give them that number that, oh, it must be in the high skilled areas. And so we don't have enough doctors, lawyers, engineers, you pick a high skilled profession, if you will, to fill those jobs. And first, that's a myth. That's not true. More than half of the current job openings require a high school degree or less, a GED equivalent or a high school degree. So more than half the job openings don't require a four-year bachelor's degree or an advanced degree. So that's a lot of entry-level jobs. That's a lot of jobs that people could take without having significant college debt or advanced degrees. And then when you look at the industry sectors, to your question specifically, about 15,000 of the job openings are either in the retail or restaurant hospitality industry. So a lot of entry-level jobs at the waiter, cook, hotel, leisure hospitality industry sector. About 15,000 job openings are in healthcare. And again, that ranges the gamut. That is your doctors and nurses, but that's also your LPNs, which is not a 2 or 4 year degree. It's a certification that's required to be a licensed professional nurse or an LPN. And there's a lot of admin and entry level healthcare positions in that 15,000 in healthcare. So that's, you know, those two industries right there, leisure and hospitality and healthcare, about 30,000 of the 77,000 job openings. So just a little less than half. After that, there's about 9,000 job openings in manufacturing. And again, that runs the gamut from high skilled labor, welders, machinists, to entry level shipping, receiving, entry level operators. And then after that, a surprising one for people, Bridget, is logistics, warehousing, and transportation. You know, people often see the Amazon facilities and the UPS facilities and FedEx facilities that have built up in Connecticut, especially post-pandemic. We have more than 1,000 job openings for CDL drivers, truck drivers, that are now paying very well at more than $100,000 a year salary. And that's because Connecticut has become a real logistics, transportation, warehousing hub post-pandemic. We have lower real estate costs than New York or Boston, yet we have access to the ports and rail lines that those two cities have. And so that's been really a growing industry in the state.
Wow. So bottom line again, and you said this, you need people, right? So interesting that, we have a lot of seniors in Connecticut, and maybe people who are done working have retired. How do you attract, Chris, then, the young people? You know, somebody grew up in Connecticut. How do you stop them from leaving, and how do you entice them into staying in Connecticut and taking a job in one of those industries, or that you mentioned, healthcare, transport, or another industry?
Yeah, that's really where the rubber meets the road is, and that's the critical question is, and the answer that comes after that, I think, is what sometimes divides policymakers in Connecticut. Some people think that we need to have more social mandates in Connecticut, you know, building on the mid-wage increase that passed in 2019, paid family leave. Last year, the legislators passed a universal paid time off, which now allows everyone to get almost 40 hours of paid time off each year, and on and on. But, you know, when you look back, those things obviously haven't driven population growth. You know, we've been doing those things since 2019, if not before, and we haven't seen state-to-state migration into Connecticut. In fact, Connecticut continues to lose people to generally the Southeast and the Midwest. We do attract some people from New York State, some people from Massachusetts, but not nearly as much as to offset what we're losing. And so when we look at the solutions that CBI has proposed, and we just released our annual package of solutions that's called Reimagine Connecticut. It's a policy pledge that we put in front of candidates because this year we have a statewide election for our legislator. Those solutions are around lowering the cost of living in Connecticut. So specifically, something we hear often from businesses and residents is our high energy costs. You know, someone who's looking to move here from the Southeast or Pennsylvania or Indiana, when we talk to those individuals about why they won't move here or why their business won't relocate here, energy is at the top of the conversation. You know, Connecticut has some of the second highest or fifth highest energy costs in the country, depending on what metric you look at. But either way, we're very expensive on the energy side. And that's just that goes right to the bottom line of an individual's paycheck. You know, if they're walking home with a certain number in their paycheck, then they got to pay their energy bill. That's at a much higher cost than elsewhere in the country.
Right.
Second to that is health insurance. You know, we have less and less insurance companies or carriers that are offering fully insured health insurance in Connecticut for our small and mid-sized businesses. And that takes a big chunk out of an employee's paycheck is the health insurance cost. And so we pushed out solutions in this Reimagine Connecticut policy pledge around creating a working group to look at Connecticut's energy plan and what's the cost associated with that plan and how do we divert some of those costs from the taxpayers or our ratepayers,
right,
our residents.
Right.
We propose other initiatives around health insurance that will allow a bunch of small businesses to pull together to lower their insurance costs. Those are the big things we hear in addition to housing.
And we are back on Newsline, also taking your calls. Perhaps you have a question about business and jobs in Connecticut, 203-333-9422. And rejoining us is Chris DePentema, the president and CEO of the Connecticut Business and Industry Association. A lot to unpack, Chris, with this report about business in Connecticut and jobs in Connecticut. And we talked about this a little bit before the break. What would you say is the number one thing that could be done in the legislature after the election to attract business, big business in particular, to Connecticut? Not too long ago, we had that story about some job cuts over at CVS. What do you think?
Yeah, just talking even to the government and the DCD commissioner, Dan O'Keefe, who often talks to businesses that are looking to expand in Connecticut or relocate to Connecticut. He specifically has said, the number one threat to Connecticut's economy is the energy cost. You know, he hears from businesses that want to expand here, the cost of energy, and or businesses that want to relocate here, that the cost of energy is the barrier for them. And that's specifically because the areas where we compete are industries that rely on a high cost but high knowledge-based workforce. So manufacturing, bioscience, data centers, artificial intelligence, which are two growing areas. Those are really our growth sectors in Connecticut. You know, manufacturing is now 12% of our economy. It's the second largest industry sector in the state. In the next couple of years, it's forecasted to be the largest industry sector in Connecticut. And so if energy is the biggest barrier for all those four of our larger industry sectors or four largest growing industry sectors, then we clearly need to deal with the cost of energy, because the increases that we all experienced this summer, it was not a one-time, one-and-done thing. We will continue to see those increases in energy bills for both the residents and the businesses. And businesses pay energy costs as well, actually at a much higher rate than the residents, because they consume a lot more energy, especially those sectors that I mentioned that are usually running 24 hours, 7 days a week, and are high energy consumers. We're going to continue to experience high energy costs because, you know, the state government officials have determined that we will be, you know, carbon free, energy neutral by whatever date, 2035 or 2040, it continues to get pushed. And there's a road to get there that's a reliance on higher energy sources like wind, solar, and things like that. And with that higher energy sources comes higher energy costs. So we'll continue to see these rate increases unless we can get our arms around How can we accomplish that goal in a way that we don't impact the ratepayers and don't impact the businesses as much? And so, is it more federal grants? Is the state pick up more of the piece of the cost, or do we slow that roadmap down, if you will, and do it over a longer period of time and not as aggressively? And that's why our number one recommendation for this session is that we create this working group. And I'm not a big fan of working groups or committees, believe me, Bridget, but this is an issue that requires multiple stakeholders to be in a room. So the utilities, the regulators, policymakers, certainly our ratepayers and our businesses, to get in a room and figure out, okay, what's the best roadmap for Connecticut? What's the best way to fund that? And then be very transparent in what that cost would be to our ratepayers and have them decide if that's the way they want to go, or is that too expensive? And mm-hmm. we just need to figure out another plan. But energy, yeah, no doubt, is the number one issue.
Yeah, it really sounds that way. And, you know, you raise the issue, Chris, and so many candidates I've talked to over the course of this campaign season, they all talk about it. And my question always is, well, how do you do something, but how do you do it fast, right? You know, people want relief right away, right? They want to say, okay, this is what it is right now, but in a couple of months, maybe the bill will look a little bit better. But as you point out, you have to create a work group. There, it doesn't seem like there is a quick solution to this, especially if you want to start looking at sustainable energy and shifting to different systems and infrastructures. It sounds like it is going to be a problem that's going to be with us for a while, I'm sorry to say.
No doubt, Bridget, and no doubt. But it's not an issue that is insurmountable. I mean, other states in the Northeast have also adapted similar clean energy initiatives, I'll say at a slower timeline than Connecticut. And they're working and making the investments necessary without burning the ratepayers with those extra costs that we've had. And so if you look just over the border to Massachusetts, the relationship between the utility in Massachusetts and government is much stronger, much better than we have in Connecticut. Ironically, it's the exact same utility, or one of the exact same utilities. Eversource is the utility in Massachusetts and also the utility in Connecticut. But the relationship between the regulators, the government, and the utility is better. The investments are being made from both the utility and the state in things like hydro, solar, wind. But it's at a manageable timeline. It's at a shared cost timeline. And it's at a way that's not burdening the ratepayers. And so businesses, you know, when they think about moving to the Northeast, because that's where you have that more knowledgeable labor force that's needed for the industry sectors that I mentioned, they look at Massachusetts. They look at New Hampshire, which has a growing economy and has the same energy goals or similar that we do. And so that's where Rhode Island is another state that's actually seeing tremendous population and economic output growth and job growth over what we have here in Connecticut. And again, similar energy goals, but they're working with each other versus having this adversarial relationship. So it's not an insurmountable thing, and we don't have to look very far to see some better practices than we have in the state of Connecticut.
Yeah. I'm probably opening up a whole other can of worms here with only a minute left, but I got to ask you, working for lower wages, this report back to the Connecticut Voices said that perhaps the sub minimum wage should be eliminated, you know, like service employees who get tips on top of a lower wage. Are you on board with that? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, we haven't. You know, that's really an issue between the restaurant industry and the hospitality and Voices for Children. Again, I think Voices' data point is spot on with the negative impact the job growth or lack of job growth has had in Connecticut. But their recommendations, I think, are a little off. When you talk to restaurant workers specifically, they want to continue to have those tip wages. They feel that if there's a sub-min wage for restaurant workers, it will take away from the amount of tips that they get and actually reduce their income overall. So I think it's critical to go to the source of those who are impacted by those type of decisions. And so I really think Voices should look at some of the things that we've talked about, you and I, with energy costs, health insurance, first-time home buyer tax credit, getting more people to help lower the costs. And I hope our candidates who are running for office, and I know you talked to many on your show, they've got to look to these pledges and either sign on to them or don't support them, but draw a line in the sand, because we need to have real solutions this coming legislative session.
All right. From your mouth to the ears of our next guest, Chris, we do have one of the candidates coming up, Chris DePentema, president and CEO of the Connecticut Business and Industry Association. We thank you so much. Hope you come back on the show again soon.
Anytime. Stay well.
Dan Woog, if you live in Westport, you know the name, right? You read his blog, 06880, where Westport meets the world. Dan, great to talk with you again.
Bridget, I'm glad to be here.
And I'm glad to be back in Connecticut. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, raised my family in Westport, and now as a somewhat slightly older person, have moved back to Connecticut, a little bit north of Westport. But in any event, your blog always brings such great, great stories to Connecticut residents. Really, anybody would be interested. And one of the stories right now that you have posted is about some scouts gathered. They gathered at Assumption Cemetery over the weekend. Can you tell us about that, Dan?
Sure. Under the direction of the Veterans of Foreign War, decorated Assumption Cemetery, Catholic Cemetery, decorated the graves of all the veterans with American flags. Seems like a little thing to do, but the flags have been removed by the cemetery for weather reasons and have not been put back. So the scouts and other volunteers went to work doing the right thing.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And it must be so meaningful for them to have an assignment like that.
It's very interesting. The Veterans of Foreign War, the VFW in Westport, is a fantastic organization. You know, they've got jazz there. They open their clubhouse to everybody. And to get the scouts involved is just one more thing they do to be part of the community. It's a great VFW.
Yeah, it sure is. We had Melissa Newman on the show. I'm sure you've written stuff about her, and the daughter of the late Paul Newman, daughter of Joanne Woodward, a singer, and she mentioned the VFW and the jazz, the wonderful, I guess, Thursday nights, right? So, yeah, that is just a great thing that maybe some people, Dan, in Westport, maybe they don't know about it.
You know what? It's tucked away at a very difficult intersection. It's been there probably 60 or 70 years. But it's, you know, you think of Westport, you don't think of the VFW. You don't think of a, you know, down-home clubhouse with a bar and all that. But
right
off exit 17, and I think anybody would have a good time there. Lunch, dinner, jazz on Thursday. VFW in Westport, go.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned this to Melissa when she was on the air with us. I stumbled upon it. They were actually holding a furniture sale there. And I really didn't know anything. You know, I just pulled into the parking lot and, you know, at one of the guys who helps run the VFW, he told me where the furniture sale was. And while I was there, I said, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? you've got a bar, you've got a restaurant. And as you say, jazz, I got to see their beautiful piano. So that's a great story. Now, this next story that you're covering, I will just share with you my Michael Douglas experience. When I lived in Westchester, he lived not far away. And when my husband and I walked our dog, I always joked around like maybe we'll run into Michael and Catherine, you know, one of these days. And one day we did, and we had a 2-second conversation. Hi, how are you? Good, thanks. And that was it. So that's my Michael Douglas, my brush with fame. But this is great. I love this story. He was celebrated. His career was celebrated in Stamford. Tell us about it, Dan.
Sure. It was a fundraiser for the Avon Theater in Stamford, a great theater. And Michael Douglas was, you know, sort of celebrated for his career achievements. But three of the guests surprised him. They flew in from all over the country. And they were former members of Downshifters. And that was a hot rod club that Michael was in when he was a teenager in Westport. You know, they got together, they worked on their cars, they learned about safety. They probably drag raced on the Merritt Parkway late at night. And Michael Douglas, a lot of people don't know, when he was a kid and a teenager, he was in Westport. His father, Kurt, was divorced. He lived with his mother in Westport, went to junior high in Westport, and then got shipped off to private school.
Huh. That is something. I didn't know he went to Bedford. That's crazy. And I didn't know he was into hot rods. And I'm trying to think, has there ever been a Michael Douglas movie involving cars? I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, there was one filmed in Bridgeport. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I can't remember the name of it, but he was in his element. You know, he was in a, you know, in a hot rod or in a car, not far from where he grew up. It was great.
Oh wow! All right. Well, now you've put me on the Google search for that during the commercial break. I'll have to take a look and try to figure out what movie that was. But that's great, and to surprise him like that sounds like a really wonderful time. You also have a beautiful story about a young man by the name of Winston Brown, a Staples senior with autism. Tell us what's special about him.
Oh man, Bridget, this is one of the most meaningful and inspiring stories I think I've ever done. Winston is a senior. He's a non-speaking autistic, you know, way high on the scale, the spectrum. And for most of his life, he was considered to be unintelligent, you know, just couldn't speak, couldn't communicate. And a couple of years ago, his parents, using a communication device where he pointed to letters, realized that there was great intelligence locked inside this non-speaking young man. And in those 2 years, using this communication device with a trained communication partner, he has not only come out of his non-speaking, he still can't speak, but he communicates, and he has deep, deep thoughts. He is highly intelligent. He can multiply three-digit numbers in his head. He wants to be a neuropsychiatrist or a neurophysician. And Cynthia Gibb and Jill Johnson Mann, two women in Westport who were involved in film, a year ago cast him in a film about himself called Presumed Incompetent. And Winston played himself. And it was, it's a remarkable, it's a short film. It's won awards. And just Saturday, a News 12 news story about Winston won an Emmy. So he is rocking the universe. And I am really honored and proud that I was able to be the first to tell his story.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I think you have a little snippet of the movie on your blog, right? Presumed Incompetent?
I do, 06880.org.
Okay. And, you know, I think the movie you're thinking of, Michael Douglas, was it And So It Goes?
That's exactly what it was.
Okay. Tell me what I've won. Michael Douglas and Diane Keaton and Dan Woog reporting on all things of interest to Westporters and all Connecticut residents. You always come up with such fantastic stories. Dan, I hope to have you back on the show very soon.
Anytime. I love WICC. You guys rock.
All right. We love your blog. All right, Dan Woog, we thank you so much. As I mentioned before the break, on Friday, we got to talk with the Democratic incumbent in the race for the Connecticut State Senate 26th District, Cece Maher. Today with us, keeping it even, Stevens, we have the Republican independent candidate for the Connecticut State Senate 26th District, Cami Evans. Cami, great to have you here. Thanks for joining the show.
Of course. Thank you so much for hosting me and doing this, because it's so important for people to be informed and know both sides and they can make their own decision. And I'm so grateful to be a candidate.
Well,
it hasn't been easy.
I'm sure it has not. And I should mention you're the candidate, I said the 26th district. When people hear that, I don't know if that is meaningful to them, but we're talking Darien, New Canaan, Reading, Ridgefield, Stamford, Westport, Weston, Wilton. Did I get everybody?
You did beautiful.
Okay.
You did beautiful, because it's like a sliver of Stamford, Darien, New Canaan, and then Lower Ridgefield. But then the four whole towns are Westport, Weston, Wilton, and Reading. So it's fascinating, because typically as you're running for office, you fundraise and then you can get the CEP grant. And there's so many rules that you learn, and it's like drinking water from a fire hose. but I'm so excited because it is my first time running. I've worked on political campaigns. I worked on Jen Tooker's campaign, and we had success with that as the first Select woman for Westport. So I'm so excited that I've got all this new information within eight towns, and I really want to share it with all the eight towns of, you know, lessons learned and how we can be stronger with this information.
Mm-hmm. So, Cami, you're no stranger to campaigns, but this is your first race. What made you decide to jump in? Was there an overriding issue? Was there something you felt was not being addressed and you said, I need to do this?
Well, when you are a single mom and you don't have a lot of time on your hands, and you're seeing affordability being a huge issue and public safety, and as you just shared about what happened in Fairfield, and Stamford is one of the towns that I am supporting, even though it's a small part, and there's a lot of danger there with the Venezuelan cartels starting to become part of that community. It's terrifying because I grew up here and I see things are changing tremendously. I have a successful business that I've basically put on hold because it's not that I was asked. I had to do this. There's so many opportunities that we are missing that, we're being taxed on things we shouldn't be taxed. Money goes up to Hartford, and then it gets decided to be sprinkled down. We need to definitely be more engaged, have more local control. And the one thing you just said, which is so important, a lot of people don't know District 26. It just was updated and redistricted last election. And a lot of people, we used to have Bethel, and now we don't for District 26. And there's a lot of confusion, a lot of new information, but that's why I really applaud you for what you do, because it gives people an opportunity to get information
right
live and on time.
Well, let me get a little information on something you just touched upon. You said cartels are becoming a problem in Stamford.
Yes.
Can you give me a specific example and what you would do to combat that problem?
Well, I was at the Stamford Police Department. They had a forum, and eight of us showed up for the forum. Unfortunately, we were all Republicans, so we couldn't share both sides of what we could be doing. And please understand, I also am very new, so I'm gathering a lot of information in a short amount of time. But we have to make sure that we back our police to be allowed to protect us. At this point in time, if somebody's smoking weed in their car, they can't be pulled over. They can't be pulled over. And if they're being exceeding a certain speed limit, they can't be chased. So we are really giving our law enforcement a very difficult time on how to protect us.
Now, so how then, Cammie, do you get them more resources or better resources?
We need to make sure that they are backed. We need to make sure that we have advocate for law enforcement and ensure like our neighborhoods are engaged in the conversations and remain safe and secure by taking away any obstacles. Right now, there's so many obstacles where they can't respond otherwise. I mean, the amount of videos, and they're constantly being questioned whenever they are making a decision on the base of safety in our communities. I would love to share with you a specific experience that I recently had. I'm a single mom of two school-age girls, 11 and 17.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming home from Weston, Connecticut, beautiful town, to Westport, another beautiful town. As I was driving my car, I have a Cadillac. It's nothing overly, opulent. A car, two young boys went around me and braked right in front of my car. And I was on the phone with my mother. And I was like, this doesn't feel right. And then they stopped. And then a few cars came behind me. And I was like, something's happening. And so then I stopped the car. And I thought it was because I'm typically a very slow driver. So I'm like, maybe they just got annoyed. That's fine. I'll deal with that. And then they went around me and then went behind me again. And then they were like kind of trying to tap the car and intimidate me. And then they went in front of me again. So I don't know if they were targeting. I don't know what they were doing. But what they were doing was not a typical experience that somebody would be having at 9:30 at night from Westport. Weston to Westport.
Well, you mentioned that, Cammie. I got to jump in because, of course, this morning we've been having a lot of news updates about this here on WICC. A guy with a gun carjacking a Porsche that was stopped at a red light right in Fairfield, another nice part of Connecticut. So you're saying something needs to be done, that the police need to be given more support to be able to crack down on crime.
And also the juveniles, because a lot of time, I don't know the age of the person who did this, but a lot, unfortunately, people are in very desperate situations, and they're making poor choices. And a lot of these young juveniles, they're 16 years old, and in order to get into certain gangs, they have to commit some sort of a crime. You know, they did it over at Lux and Bond, where they did the clash and grab with all the jewelry store.
In Westport, and, right?
Yeah, in Westport, yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of the day, 2:30 in the afternoon, like, are you joking me? This is, you know, and they've been around for almost 100 and I think 40 or 50 years, Lux Bond Green.
Yeah, they've been there forever. So a big part of your platform, Cami, is to crack down on crime.
Juvenile reform, and not just mm-hmm. because right now, if they commit a crime, they're just catch and release.
Right.
They've got to be tried as if you commit some sort of a crime, you have to be like sent to a juvenile reform program. First of all, it needs to stop, and we have to look at it in two ways. We have to prevent this from ever happening, and we have to work with our neighboring districts, because it's not just about District 26; it's about all the districts. And we have to make sure that they're getting what they need so that this does not become like an opportunity. And then we have to also make sure that if somebody does commit this crime, we have to get them. It can't be a 16-year-old catch and release. We have to put in laws that will not allow them.
And to prevent any potential further crimes down the road.
Exactly.
We are back with the Republican and independent candidate for the Connecticut State Senate 26th District, Cami Evans. We were just talking about crime. Let's talk about energy. Cami, I don't expect you to have heard our previous interview, but we were talking with somebody about Connecticut business and the state of employment here in Connecticut. And basically, his point was, if we are going to attract businesses to stay in Connecticut, you need to bring the energy costs down. And unfortunately, it seems like a lot of the solutions are long-term solutions. Is there anything that you could do, if elected, to bring those energy prices down ASAP?
I wish I had that magic wand.
Don't we all?
But I think they're absolutely right. I was listening in to what he was saying. There's a few things to unpack from the balcony, and I think one course I took recently. I was a part of the public leadership credentials at Harvard Kennedy School, and the one point that always comes to me is when they say when there's change, everybody thinks they're going to lose something. So everybody's thinking, oh, my God, what are we going to do with these pet projects, with the public benefits, and what are we going to lose? People have taken the time to put these together, and they're not really resonating and working out the way they're supposed to be. You've got two things with the public benefits with regards to energy costs, is that there's so many pet projects in it, but there's no transparency. Thanks to Ryan Fazio, the state senator for Greenwich, Stamford, and parts of New Canaan that I work along with, hopefully we'll be up in Hartford together, but he's put a plan to make it transparent. They've always been a part of what we've been charged, but it's never been very obvious to us. And as a person who lives currently in 850 square feet, I pay $500 a month, which is ridiculous, and 230 of that is public benefits. So we need to change that immediately. But then you have the challenge of the EV vehicles in under those pet projects, and then the people who have EV vehicles like CCMAR, that they get the $7,500 rebate for having an EV vehicle. So you have, you can't milk the cow dry. Either you support one way, or you get the EV vehicle and you refuse that $7,500, because right now we're also losing a lot of top talent. I was at a few opportunities speaking on with professionals that it's so expensive staying in town. People are cashing out, but they don't know where to go. Affordability is a huge issue.
Right. And Cami, if I can just jump in, I do want to talk about affordability. But okay, so let's say you and Fazio are both, able to work together. Day one in office, what do you do to try to bring that relief when it comes to your monthly electric bill?
Those public benefits, we have to make it transparent. We need to take off all the fat that's associated with it, all the pet projects that are not going to immediately support our communities, so that we don't have there are great opportunities to work with the private sector as well, but we really need to have like a total understand where all this money is going. Everyone's getting taxed. It's going somewhere, but we can't milk the cow dry. And right now, I'm a constituent right now running for elected office, right? And there's so much that I'm uncovering right now that's just, it's all being hidden. Like, how come we're not being clear about it? And we need to really stop these tremendous unfunded mandates that keep on being, you know, like a wand across, okay, this is what we're doing, but no one's going to, we don't know how to pay for it. So we have to be very clear. Because that's the hardest part. I was with at an event, and the pediatricians and the Connecticut Children's Hospital were speaking there, and there's so much data and so much information that they want to gather, but it was mandated and not funded. And they're like, we need your support as legislators how to go about paying for this, because we're only allowed to spend 20 minutes with a patient. And then we have to gather all this information, and we don't have the, they don't have the resources. And we have to, you know, these are like first responders at this point.
Yeah. Okay. Cami, so many issues, right? And gosh, we're just 8 days away from the election. One other thing I wanted to ask you about was you've been quoted as saying that you don't want overreach from Hartford. Now, I'm assuming that that comment was made in the context of bringing more affordable housing to Connecticut. How do you balance that? How do you, you as a legislator, if elected, how do you help build more affordable housing in the state of Connecticut, in particular, obviously District 26, but at the same time take into account concerns of current residents?
There's a few things. There's being clear about incorporating ADUs into the plans, which I know Westport's been very good at. There's opportunities for housing unit equivalent numbers and scaling them so that they could be affordable housing incorporated into it. I know there's 98,000 homes needed for Connecticut, but we have so many unhoused and veterans. We have so many people who are living below the poverty line. And I was, this is a discussion that has to also bring in affordable housing and low income housing, which are two totally different things. I was in a meeting at the Rotary Club, and there's a nonprofit in Norwalk that was sharing, in order for someone to qualify for $1,500 low-income housing, pretty much they have to be making $80,000 or $80,000 to qualify for low-income housing. I mean, for me, that's a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah, it's a big salary.
It is. And they're saying the average person makes about, in order to have a $2,000 one-bedroom apartment, you need at least $108,000 of revenue, generating revenue a year. That's a lot. And that is where this beautiful state, which I grew up in, I grew up in Stamford, I've lived in Westport and New Canaan, I've also lived in Fairfield. This part of Connecticut, we're losing tremendous talent. People are leaving, and we've got to work better.
Right.
In a few ways, we have to work for pathways when kids are getting out of high school, find other ways for tradesmen, find other ways for gap years and for postgraduate years. The stress with mental health for the whole family. We need to make the whole family thrive, and then it'll build upon our communities. And I know you may know
One of the many, many issues that I'm sure you will be tackling if elected to the Connecticut State Senate 26th District. Cami, we are out of time, sorry to say, but thank you very much for joining the program. Cami Evans, the Republican Independent candidate for the Connecticut State Senate 26th District. Cami, thank you for your time. Election Day just 8 days away now. Can you believe it? I almost said 8 days a week. Feels like we talk about it that much, right?